As we struggle to agree on the American narrative, what we are or aren't all about, the collective thread of understanding ourselves seems to fray further every year. If there are any uniquely American phenomena that might endure even after our conception of civic identity collapses, they may be the pursuit of happiness and the singer-songwriter. Before we had singer-songwriters, we had professional songwriters and professional singers, and we didn't expect that the person performing a song was necessarily telling you their own personal story or singing their truth. It was a more organized setup. It was more stratified. Then came folks and folkies like Bob Dylan, a man who told the truth through a veil of untruths. His name, his biography, his persona were all inventions of his own making. Dylan is self-invention personified, and self-invention is something America has always cherished. Among writers, certainly songwriters, there's a persistent question. Do you have to be honest in order to tell the truth? Or truthful in order to be honest? Dylan is a lie that tells the truth, or maybe he's a truth that wears the mask of a lie. Either way, it's very American. And the pursuit of happiness, that's been at the heart of the American project for 2.5 centuries. And it's worth remembering that it was itself a kind of American invention. John Locke had previously written about life, liberty, and property. Thomas Jefferson swapped out property for the pursuit of happiness, and a kind of national religion was born. The French, for example, took a different approach. They wrote about liberty, equality, and fraternity. How French? No mention of happiness at all. But it does raise a question. What might have happened if, instead of pursuing happiness, Jefferson had set us on a path toward pursuing something else? Like maybe contentment. Madison Cunningham, one of the great American singer-songwriters of her generation, is pursuing contentment, and she's doing it by being honest and telling the truth. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. There's a character in Ernest Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises who describes how he went bankrupt. He says it happened two ways, gradually, then suddenly. For Madison Cunningham, recovering from a breakup is similar. For her, it happens all in time and suddenly.
All in time and suddenly. All in time and suddenly. All in time and suddenly.
This simple, literate turn of phrase encapsulates Cunningham's comfort with borrowing from and writing into the traditions, musical, songwriting, even emotional. It also feels like a quiet thesis statement for the moment she's in. Madison is not yet 30, but she's already lived through a chapter of life that many people don't reach until much later. She got married young, she got divorced young, and she found herself catapulted into a strange, accelerated adulthood. She felt out of sync with her peers and unsure of what her life was supposed to look like anymore. Madison Cunningham grew up in Orange County, California, the eldest of 5 daughters in a deeply musical Christian household. Her father was a worship pastor, and by the age of 12, she was playing electric guitar in the church band on a huge stage in front of thousands, long before she'd ever heard the music of the Beatles or Joni Mitchell. When she finally discovered secular music as a teenager, it felt like someone had cracked open a new universe. She released her first EP at 15, followed by Love, Lose, Remember in 2017, which was a folk-leaning, intimate introduction.
Sometimes love comes like the morning, hiding inside of the gloom. Sometimes it falls like an evening. Sometimes love falls when you.
But her breakthrough came with Who Are You Now in 2019. That one was a Grammy-nominated, guitar-forward record that established her as a serious songwriter with a singular harmonic sensibility.
I'll make the best out of the worst. I'll make up half the words. And where tea should ever been, I've never heard. Because it hurts to be on the outside looking in. Well, I do my best to listen. And
does that mean? I said, I'm learning to live with the violence, violence, but I'm not the kind that wants to be lost. I don't want to be forgotten. I don't want to pretend that it's alright. I want to see these walls crumble and dissolve around me.
And then came Revealer in 2022. Which won the Grammy for Best Folk Album and deepened the picture. She toured with Chris Thiele and Andrew Bird. John Mayer called her one of his favorite new artists. The career was quietly and steadily rising. Then, as it often does, life intervened. Her new record, Ace, was written in the aftermath of that dismantling, the divorce, the loneliness, the recalibration of identity. The songs aren't angry, they are awake, though. They're trying to make sense of what contentment really means when the old scaffolding disappears.
I've been spinning out on too many big words you could do without, and everything we did.
We got together recently to talk about all of this, the early church years, discovering secular music, the rise of her career, divorce and reconstruction, happiness and contentment, tunings and pianos, what it means to tell the truth in public. Madison Cunningham was raised in a kind of musical isolation, but she remembers a small handful of teachers and mentors who turned her on to new ideas and helped broker her breakthroughs. Her dad was her first musical influence, but she tells me that there was a family friend, Danny Donnelly. She says, he's still one of my favorite guitar players, and he was kind of throwing those curveballs at me, being like, what if you tuned your guitar like this? Madison says those initial moments are still so almost sacred and holy because it just felt so world-altering to have those small little changes made on the guitar. For any young person discovering their relationship to music, those first guides, the ones who say, try this, what if you tuned it like that, are everything. If you have a young budding musician in your life, Musication is a wonderful resource to help you find the right teacher. Musication offers in-home music lessons in Brooklyn and Manhattan for kids age 3 and up. Their teachers are highly experienced professional musicians themselves, and every lesson is tailored to each child's interests and needs, with flexible scheduling that fits into real life. Life is busy, your kids are busy, you are busy, Musication teachers come to you. And as a special offer for Third Story listeners, email lessons at musication.nyc, mention the podcast, and you'll receive 2 free trial lessons. Musication was founded by my friend Jeremy Zamuda, a guitarist, songwriter, and lifelong educator. Jeremy and I even made a record together years ago called Jeremy Plays Guitar, with songs featuring Captain Kirk of The Roots, Madeline Peru, and Alan Hampton. At the start of my conversation with Madison Cunningham, I reminded her that we first met through Alan Hampton, who's been a longtime collaborator of hers. So it's all connected. The arc of mentorship, collaboration, and discovery, and Musication is actually part of that continuum. Visit third-story.com to explore the archive, hundreds of deep dives like this one, including past episodes with friends and contemporaries of Madison's like Alan Hampton, Andrew Bird, Larry Klein, Jake Sherman, Jacob Collier, Theo Katzman, Julian Lage, plus Madeline Peru, John Ellis, and lots, lots more. Visit my Substack for writings, musings, and new episodes. That's where you can sign up for the mailing list as well, and you can support this project too. And remember, we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning content. If you like this podcast, consider telling a friend or leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Here's me and Madison Cunningham talking it down. Madison Cunningham.
Yeah.
We met once before in Paris with Alan Hampton.
Yes. That's right, that's right.
I was playing drums, Alan was playing bass, my dad was playing piano in a little jazz club.
Oh my God, yes. I remember that moment very well.
I remember it too. And I followed up that year to see if we could talk. I think it was maybe 2022.
Yeah.
We were supposed to meet in Madison, Wisconsin. I love the idea of doing Madison in Madison, but my plane got canceled. And then last week, your label mentioned that you were going to be in town, and we set this up. And I was thinking, as I listened to your record, you have this phrase that I really love in the song Mummy, where you say, it's all in time and suddenly. That's how I feel about this conversation in a way. And I actually feel that that's how life is.
Mm.
Like, it either takes a really long time for things to happen, or they just kind of come upon you.
Or alternatively, things take ages to happen. And then when they do happen, you're like, oh, it kind of feels as though it has the illusion of it maybe having happened instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Like on the outside.
Yes.
Even though you know, you're like, this has been working internally for within me for a long time. That phrase, I appreciate you mentioning it because I was really proud of it at the time. It felt like it was encapsulating sort of the idea of just when you think you're never going to get over someone
mm-hmm.
or something, and then suddenly you see a picture and you're like, I feel nothing.
Yes.
And I wish them well, but it's like that relief. It takes so long for that to happen that you don't really register the process of it almost, or you don't register the moment that it happens. You just know that it shifted.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird, yeah.
Right. You don't recognize it until it's already happened in
yeah.
a way. You seem very open about talking about how personal, particularly this record is. But I mean, I think in the past also you've been open about it. I mean, you brought it up right away. This is about a breakup. This is about it. And as a matter of fact, I realized in reading about this record that when I met you, I must have met you with your then husband also. I mean, are you not yet 30? Or did you just turn 30? Or you
just turned 29.
Just turned 29. So you're 29.
Yeah.
I mean, I got married at like 32. You've already been through a whole chapter in your life that a lot of people don't even come to until they're, especially in you know, younger generations. You've lived a lot of relationship life already.
Yeah. I felt isolated by the whole experience because, you know, I got married very young, divorced very young, and I didn't know anyone, first of all, that was my age and married, didn't know anyone who's my age and divorced. So
mm-hmm.
I was divorced. You know, I was like joining these like quote unquote, like they weren't actual divorce clubs, but like groups of people who had been through that. And they were all like 10 to 20 years older than me. And that was beautiful and needed it in some moments. And then I felt even further away from like just my people or something. It was a really interesting time in my life trying to find what the future could possibly look like. And I just couldn't see it for, you know, at least 9 months.
Yeah.
Or to a year. Like, and I was still putting the pieces back together. And yeah, that's kind of all I'll say about that. But yeah, I actually have not been able to avoid talking about it because I'm not a very good liar. And also like, I don't like the songs are very like, forthcoming about it, you know?
You talk about not feeling connected to your people. Your people could mean a lot of different things, right? Like, I think maybe generationally, you're like a little estranged from a lot of other people's experiences because you were already married, but you were also already signed and you were already on a path. There were a lot of things that kept you on your own independent track really young, not just the marriage thing, but also like your career, the way you approached it.
Completely. Yeah, I've always felt actually, that's a beautiful point because I think I've always felt sort of isolated or like I didn't know who I could really like vibrate with or really feel understood by. And that bleeds into all sorts of parts of life that I was really unprepared for. And now I feel like that landscape has changed. And I'm in the time of like that great sort of like dismantling and suffering within that, I did find my people. I found the people who maybe didn't have the exact experience because that wasn't the point. It was the people who like had the capacity to hold the complexity of my situation and because they know they have complexity or they've gone through their own versions of things like that. And I don't know, that was just, that has to be one of the greatest gifts of the whole meltdown.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that in a way it brings you into focus with people who you wouldn't have been connected with before. I mean, I was thinking like, okay, well, Chris Thiele was your people and Andrew Bird was your people. And like a lot of people who are older, but maybe you could relate to because you were having so many of these experiences that people in your own generation weren't having.
Yes.
And now what I'm hearing you say is like, I also kind of can chill with like other 29-year-olds and relate to them in some way.
Yes. Yeah, that was such a relief. I had met, like, I remember this one specific night I was at a taco stand in LA a year and a half ago and just met this crew of people who are now like, we all just went camping together. 2 weeks ago. And there's something about that. I was like, oh, we're all just like, we're all in similar spaces reaching for similar things, but like we know how to support each other in that. And there's no like competition. That's very rare. It's rare to find that. I've discovered, and not all of them, like a lot of them are musicians. Some of them are songwriters, like in all aspects of the quote unquote field, you know, and then like, and some of them have nothing to do with music. They're just wonderful people. And like, yeah, that's the kind of stuff I think I long for. I kind of get in these loops of wondering what is really, why do we stress so much about making it to the top? Like, what is really up there? And what is really, you know, is it worth it? Is it worth losing things over? And I would say no. My biggest concern in this time in my life is trying to understand the difference between happiness and contentment and really working on contentment and gratitude. And it's very hard, but I appreciate that practice over chasing the happiness crave or high, you know.
What do you see as the difference?
I think happiness is something that is, it can be quite hollow, it can be quite shiny on the outside, and contentment is quite rooted and rich, and it doesn't deny any of it. It doesn't deny the sadness or the joy or that. It's ground zero for, I think, truth.
You know, this idea that you can be content and experience sorrow, or content and experience loss, or content and experience discomfort, or content and experience pain. You know, like, I think we are in a time when somehow we're trying to eliminate pain from our lives as if a life without pain is somehow preferable. I mean, obviously we don't want to suffer, but pain is a very, you know, it comes with the human experience. And yet we're constantly trying to somehow like paint pain out of the picture.
Yeah, we're trying to numb it away, and that just means you numb everything else too.
Yeah.
I guess contentment also, like, to go back to this picture, it's like, I think contentment isn't afraid of the feeling of pain. It lets it pass through.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to dive into that idea for myself, because I don't want to just like miss out on the depth of building relationship and the time that it takes. And yeah, I don't want to miss out on those, on the cornerstones of life.
I want to talk about the record. I love this record, but I also want to talk about the journey, because I actually am kind of new to learning about the fullness of your journey. For example, your first musical relationship was basically with praise and worship music, or you were raised in a very Christian household. Your father was a minister.
Yeah.
And that was how you started playing music.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Grew up in Orange County. I was actually born in San Diego, grew up in Orange County. And my dad was the head worship pastor at a mega church there.
A mega church.
Mega church, yeah. I guess that would be the definition. I mean, it didn't function like you would see a mega church functioning now. Like, there wasn't like all of the like smoke and mirrors, and like it was.
Was it in-ears?
There were in-ears, yes.
I think if there's in-ears, it's a mega church.
Yeah, true. And the sanctuary kind of went for miles, you know? But yeah, I mean, he was there for 22 years, and I grew up within that structure, and that was kind of like, those are the first stages I ever stood on.
But that's not a humble stage. That's like you walking onto huge stage then.
Oh, yeah. I had no idea what I was walking into. Like, I had no idea, like, that sometimes, like, I remember getting this message from someone I didn't know. They were anonymous, but they were a congregant who said to me, it would be really nice if you'd wash your hair every once in a while so I could focus on worshiping God. And there were so many things that I was doing wrong by just being on that stage. Like, it was like, you know, it was a very tricky place to be. And me and my dad have a wonderful relationship, but it was a tricky place to make music from,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think he would agree. It was hard for him too.
Yeah.
Eventually met Tyler Chester, who I wonder if you know.
Yep.
And he just kept kind of like roping me into things. In
How
Los
did
Angeles.
You meet him? How did he discover you? Did you?
No. We met at the NAMM show.
Uh-huh.
Hilariously, that's the last time either one of us have been, and we've decided we're going to boycott because we're afraid of meeting like our arch nemesis next time. You know, that's just the way.
Because you found your person the first time.
Exactly.
So you're gonna, the inevitable.
It's like, the laws of gravity. Yeah.
Right.
So. Yeah, anyway, we met, and my dad, I went with my dad, and he...
Looking for some new in-ears.
Yeah, I was looking for some Avioms, some Ultimate ears, capos, you name it.
Gear, he was looking for gear.
We were just looking for gear,
yeah.
And a good time. And anyway, he ran into Tyler, he had known of him, and kind of just started pitching me to Tyler, and I was so mortified. I kept, like, kind of... hitting my dad's hand, being like, can you please stop doing this? Anyway, I could tell Tyler was really disinterested. I think he was just like, you're a kid. I have no idea. There's no way I'm doing this.
How old were you?
15, 16.
And your dad's saying she's really talented. She's a great singer. She's a good guitar player. She writes songs.
Yeah. So somehow after that, I remember feeling that interaction didn't go very well. And I think they found each other like over text again, and Tyler ended up agreeing to meet with me. And even in that meeting, I knew him like, this guy does not want to be here. Like, I don't think he's convinced. And then we laugh about this story all the time because Tyler said that he, I guess, saw me play a G chord. And I can't describe necessarily here how it happened or how I played it, but he knew that like I loved guitar.
Yeah.
Do
you know what he's talking about though? You can't describe it, but you know what he's talking about?
Yeah. I know what he's talking about. I don't have the descriptor words for it, but like, I know I still play it like that. And he was like, I'm in, let's do this. And that relationship just started my life. Like, we ended up making a record together after that that's no longer available because I, you know, I have beginner's embarrassment about it. it was a different lifetime.
Is that record called Authenticity?
Yeah.
I think that is ironic that your record called Authenticity is the one that you say, it doesn't ring true.
I know. Well, also, like, the fact that I called it that should tell you something about it's like, it was swinging. It was swinging for something. I think it really missed. But the point was that it brought Tyler into my life, and I felt like I had a path forward. I realized, like, from talking to a lot of fellow artists and musicians, how lucky that interaction was, because so many people build their worlds on their own and by like making calls to restaurants, like, can we play at, you know, in the corner? Can we, like, and I didn't have to do a lot of, like, he was there with me and kind of championing me through a lot of the early days. And yeah, I feel really lucky saying that.
Yeah.
And now I live in his back house.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. We live in Frogtown together.
You were already writing songs.
Yeah.
What was your relationship with writing songs going all the way back? I know a little about how you felt that you weren't going to be able to tell the truth or be honest fully as long as you were writing worship songs.
Yeah, well, I kind of lost my relationship to understanding why I was writing those songs.
Like, but when you first started writing songs, was your assumption, I have to write songs for this purpose?
Yeah, I had no heroes at that point.
Huh.
Like, I didn't hear the Beatles until I was 17, the day I graduated high school.
Because no secular music at home?
Yeah, no secular music. And, like, that wasn't even a hard and fast rule. I just didn't, like, like the secular music my sisters were finding, I really
who are younger,
hated.
You're the oldest.
Yeah, it was like Justin Bieber and One Direction. Like that was my generation's drug. And I just, yeah, I found zero interest in it. But just, you know, I was kind of like, I was given these songwriting structures that I was around. So I was kind of like diving into those and then breaking some of those rules naturally. And like, I just was excited by the ways in which harmony and chord structure work. And I didn't have the language for that. Like, I just was kind of like, oh, this would be cool. What if I had a lot, I was homeschooled. I had a lot of time to sit in my room and find different shapes on the guitar. And I, again, like,
in different tunings?
Different tunings. Like, I started playing in open tunings when I was 15. Hadn't even heard Joni Mitchell yet. I just was, like, just interested in a family friend, Danny Donnelly, was still one of my favorite guitar players. He was kind of throwing those curveballs at me, being like, what if you tuned your guitar like this? And like, those initial moments are still so almost, like, sacred and holy because, you know, it just felt so world-altering to have those small little changes made to my guitar. I was so funny enough, this is very nerdy, but my guitar was in open D, which I believe is dadgad,
yeah,
officially. And then Tyler was like, what if you changed the G to an F sharp?
Mm-hmm. Then you have a D then, major.
Yeah, and that really changed the way that I played in open tunings, that small little.
And you remember, so you remember all those moments when somebody would say, do this, well, if you try that. And
absolutely.
And then you hear Joni Mitchell, and is there a part of you that thinks, like, are you, oh my God, this has been here the whole time, how did I not know this? Or do you just say, I relate to this person, I feel like we're part of the same lineage? I mean, like, what did you feel?
I don't think I had discovery shame.
Yeah.
I don't think I was like...
Discovery shame is, what a great term.
You know?
I feel that all the time.
I do too, I do now.
Yeah.
The most I ever have in my life, probably. But I think I was so removed. I felt so seen by it. I wasn't thinking, where has this been? It felt like it was written in that moment.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, this is what I wanted to say to you about Ace, about hearing your new record. Every now and then, I have an experience where, I mean, I'll say, it happened to be yesterday getting a haircut where they played a Nick Drake record, and I was like, this sounds like it was made today.
Wow.
This sounds like a brand new record, and it's like 50 years old.
I saw it written and I saw it say, I think the moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall.
And hearing your record, I thought, we're living in a very chaotic time in the world, and I think a lot of artists are trying to figure out what is their job in the face of all of this to bear witness to what's happening today.
Mm.
And your new record is so intensely personal, and yet it feels completely like it's made for right now. But I also think that if you made it 5 years ago or 5 years from now, it would still feel like it's made for right now. I just think when you hear somebody going through something and being completely honest about it and creating their own world around it, it always feels contemporary and it always feels modern. You
that
know?
Is like the best thing you could have ever said to me. I don't think there's a deeper compliment than that. Like, that was the fear, was that diving into these very personal themes was in the end going to come out just self-indulgent.
Yes.
Or just something that was like inaccessible, not because of its headiness, but
yeah,
because of its specificity or
right.
something.
But it's that cliche and it keeps giving. The personal is universal. That stuff does translate.
Yeah, that's the perfect way to say it. And I love that that continues to be true because
yeah,
it's the most fascinating Rubik's Cube. Yeah, just like this thing that keeps shifting, like no matter where you kind of turn it, you're like, oh yeah, like if the main equation that you're going off of is honesty, then I think people are gonna find something of value in it.
Yes. Well, it's like honesty is always on time.
Yeah, yeah. Beautifully said.
So
Something else, though, you know, you talk about how the guitar was with you from the very beginning, and like people freak out about your guitar playing. That's been a big part of, I think, your musical identity has been your relationship with the guitar. And then you make this record that's is actually as much guitar as it is piano, but it opens with a lot of piano. So I think it sort of reads as a piano record. Because this was an album that came out of a process of rebirth.
Yeah.
Part of the process was I'm going to write on an instrument that isn't my familiar place or hasn't been my...
It wasn't calculated. It was something that I was enjoying. It was my dad's piano got moved into my apartment. It's felted and it's a spinet piano. And I don't think I've heard a more beautiful and friendly piano in my life. And my interest just went there.
Yeah.
And I was naturally writing songs. I would start writing songs on guitar and I would move them to piano. I had this because I've always been in open tunings for the most part, or I'm like down tuned to basically baritone.
Yeah.
The piano taught me what I've been playing in open tunings. Like I learned so much. Like I had almost theory to back which keys I was in, and like it was one of my favorite musical times. I just felt like everything was just like, I felt as a person I was like disintegrating, but I was kind of like finding where like my love was for music was popping up in these very unexpected places. And I just thought like it would be a crime to then suddenly put on my branding hat, which is an insufferable hat to begin with, to then be like, I don't know, Maddie, do you do this? Maybe you should go back to guitar. I just felt like I had to just get out of the way.
Yeah.
And by doing that, piano kept kind of coming into the picture. And I don't know, I wasn't freaking out about it. I wasn't like, I knew it was going to be confused. I knew people were going to talk about that.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of glad.
But it's also very accomplished piano playing. I mean, it's not like, oh, I wish you'd get back to the guitar so we could hear some real music. You know, I mean, the piano is serving these songs so beautifully and you're playing it so beautifully.
Thank you.
But the thing about open tuning is interesting. I mean, I suppose if you live in open tuning, then you become very familiar with what's going to happen. But it seems to me that one of the things that open tunings allows is for discovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to follow your ear because you just don't know what is going to happen when you put your finger, at least that's how I am, where it's like,
oh yeah,
I don't know what this shape is going to sound like until I hear it.
No, I'm the exact same way. And this tuning I had never played in before.
Uh-huh. On the whole record?
A whole record.
Oh really?
Yeah.
What is it?
C, C, G, D, F, A, C.
Okay.
C, G, D, F, A, C, yeah.
So
this is sort of like suspended. It was a really frustrating tuning, actually. The first song that I used it for was Wake. And then it kind of started to just make sense because the song was telling me where to go. And then I kind of found these shapes along the way. And it helped me write all the other tunes from there.
You say that you could do me home. The safety of your arms, while your eyes are adding bones dropping. My head is full of thunder clouds, keeping aircraft on the ground. Who will win this lightning round of suffering?
So, a combination of finding this tuning, having this piano brought in, because my understanding is you were a little blocked, having trouble figuring out how to write, and you get a few gifts dropped in your lap. You get the piano, you find this tuning, and then also you finally have this flood of stuff to say.
Yeah.
And you wrote the whole, most of the collection in a pretty short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of it was like from August to October. We were supposed to record in mid-October. Yeah, I mean, it's such a romantic story to tell in retrospect, but I was like, this weird mix of feeling like I didn't care about anything and also panicked. And I was upset by the people who were kind of like rubbing their hands together, being like, ooh, I know what you're going through. This is going to be a good record. I just was like...
You felt that. There are people watching you go through this and go, this is going to be great.
Yeah. And I felt misunderstood and angry. because it made me feel as though they were saying to me, like, oh, you did all this just so that you could write a great piece of art. And I wasn't feeling like I had anything to say. I just felt like I was full of liquid. Like everything, all my thoughts, my feelings were just like water. It felt like there was not a lot of substance. And then finally it kind of just like turned into shapes. And there were things that I was like, that's what I want to say. That's what my anger sounds like. That's what my love feels like. That's what my devastation, like, and I started writing to people that I couldn't speak to anymore. And I'm the classic case of a person who walks away with all the things I wanted to say, but didn't know how to say in the moment. So maybe that's why songwriting has made sense in my life. But,
so you think you discover how you feel when you write it in a song?
Yeah. And also when I'm alone, I'm a recovering people pleaser. I would say I'm just now becoming acquainted with how I feel in the moment while it's happening.
Mm.
And maybe the gift is learning how to not react and to just like hold it and to stand still with it until you know how to identify what it is. But I've always, most of my life, I've walked away feeling like I didn't like really get to the fucking punchline in time. And so, yeah, that it felt really cathartic to find some of these lines and to be like, that's it. That's what I wanted to say to you. Or that's what I wanted to say to myself. Or this is how I wish I would have confessed to this thing.
Yeah.
And better, or whatever it is.
I've done all these interviews and they serve as almost like a kind of graduate school for me. Like I feel like my own education has been through one conversation at a time. And I remember certain things that people have said to me. And I remembered the songwriter Jesse Harris said to me last year, everybody assumes that Joni Mitchell is a confessional songwriter or that James Taylor is a confessional songwriter. And just because it feels confessional doesn't mean that that happened to her.
Right.
You know, and I was asking him about, I was interrogating a bunch of his songs and he was like, I don't know what that means. It didn't happen to me. That's not something that necessarily, or maybe it will happen to me, or, you know. And yet, I think you are very open here that these are things that you wanted to say and that you were feeling, and these are not songwriting exercises, at least not on this record. These are like, this is feelings that are being processed through your craft. So how do you deal with the performative aspect of opening your own closet to the world?
Not doing very well with it right now. I'm struggling with how I feel on display in this yeah. way that I don't know I fully want yeah. or that I was prepared for, and it's put me into a tailspin in this moment, and just yeah, I want to protect the people that I love. I want to protect myself. But I guess to answer you honestly, I don't know how to do it, and I feel very out of my depth, and it's all like a moment at a time, and I keep kind of going back to the drawing board being like, how do I talk about this? It's kind of like, what's that phrase, dancing about architecture? Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like I will ever be able to explain it, and talking about it feels, yeah, I don't know. It's been a crazy journey so far. That's the best way to put it.
You don't have to talk. We were talking about it, and I knew that you were talking about it because I read, I mean, it's literally in the press release of the record. It's like, this is yeah. what it's about. This is how I did it. This is what, you know, so I got a sense that is part of the way you're, I don't know, framing this project.
Yeah, I couldn't see, I don't know, I think that's the way the songs are framed, and the hard part about, like, I believe in them so much.
Yeah.
And the really messy, like, sort of like exchange with press has never felt so like loaded for me.
Yeah.
I felt really like, whoa, I don't want to say the wrong thing, yet I really would love to feel the liberation of being honest. So it's this weird dance that I guess it's just helpful to say now that I don't feel like I'm doing well all the time.
Yeah.
I've walked away from a lot of things going like, what was I, who was I batting for in that moment? Was it for like the integrity of getting a cool interview across and like a
yeah.
like a puff piece? Like I don't, yeah. or was it to save myself and that's like, and other people, and that's not a very, you can feel when there are things that are dishonest and being withheld, or when you're not telling the whole picture because I'm not creative enough to lie.
Right. No, I'm getting that from you that you're saying that I don't know how to lie. I have to just tell the truth. This is what's happening. It's interesting to you say, well, who was I batting for in that situation? And it's kind of harkens back to this thing that you said earlier. I'm a recovering people pleaser. So like you're walking into a situation and kind of reading the room and thinking like, what do they need me to be in this moment?
Right. I mean, maybe it's less of who do they need me to be and more of like, what do I want out of this? What am I willing to actually give?
Yeah.
And maybe it is rooted with like, what does this interview need?
Yeah.
To be great. And I'm trying to, yeah. It's what an interesting set of things. I'm trying to not like give in to that fear. Like, I don't know. I wish it was more like Bob Dylan is basically what.
Totally. Well, so that's the interesting thing. I don't even think Bob Dylan could be like Bob Dylan today because all of the expectations that are placed on an artist are like, you don't just get to live in the songs anymore.
Yeah. Do you mean like the stories of the songs?
You'd ask Bob Dylan a question. He'd give you 10 different answers on a different day. I mean, everything about Bob Dylan was an invention. His name, his story, the songs spoke for themselves.
Yeah.
And he didn't have to do any talking for it. But he also, I just think, like, does a 22-year-old Bob Dylan who comes along today, is he on Instagram? Is he on TikTok? Can he have a career if he's not?
Yeah, I mean, the answer's probably no. He probably can't.
Right. But the music obviously lives on its own terms and speaks for itself.
Yeah.
You don't have to.
Totally.
I don't know what you...
What I'm doing here?
Well, I mean, some of me wonders if it does go back to the church thing. Like, you know, those people saying, wash your hair so I can worship. Like, there's this message that was sent to you and you knew enough to get out of there. But, like, there was this message that was like, we need you to be this thing for us.
Yes. And, of course, because my primary worry in life was conflict.
Right.
Then I was going to adopt all of those instructions and I was going to become that. And that's what I mean, I still have that thing where I'm like, I just want peace. Yeah. I want everyone to be happy and everything to be okay. And like, sometimes you can have that, but that's at the cost of like, what's actually going on with people or depth the last 2 years have been the messiest years of my life. And so I've talked about like, having to really stand behind your decisions and your, like, that's been a really heavy thing for me. And it's been the most important thing that's ever happened.
More important than, like, it doesn't sound like it was that hard to start singing secular music or to leave the church and to decide, but I imagine that was probably, and your grandmother was very active in the church and wanting you to do a certain thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a whole lineage of people who, you know, like I also feel so loved by.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the most beautiful. Like my parents are such, like, I don't think you'll meet two kinder, more nuanced people. Like my mom also, she's just such an emotionally intelligent woman and like knows how to reach people and knows how, they're just really, my parents held me through the disastrous couple of years and they, you know, they like, even I was also the oldest kid. Like and they were kids. I always forget that, like the moments where I remember my mom being.
How old was she
pregnant.
When you were born?
Yeah. She's 21.
When you were born?
When I was born. Yeah. And so like when I witness and remember my mom, like.
So you have a memory of her, you're 8 years old. She's the age that you are now.
Exactly. And those are the moments I remember her kind of the most. And I remember her being supremely stressed, of course. And then she was just, I remember knowing that she always had this like moat. When she would break down, she'd just laugh. Like she was such a pleasant person to be around, given how much, like if I had 5 kids running around right now, I would be.
So she's 50.
Just turned 50.
Right, and I'm turning 49 right now. Like, I'm the age of your parents.
Yeah, my dad's 52. They're like, they're young.
It's crazy to me to think that I could have a 30-year-old daughter or a 29-year-old daughter.
Yeah, absolutely. You totally could. And do you have kids?
I have a 14-year-old, yeah.
Okay. Well, you're not, it'll happen like that.
I know, it's going to happen. As I'm saying, I'm like, this is not going
to
take that
long. I don't believe that I'm 29. Yeah. Like, I can't believe I'm about to be a 30-year-old. Well, a year away from now, but it's this weird, I'm like, I already consider myself to be 30 in preparation.
Right. I feel that way about 50. I'm turning 40. I'm 20 years old. I'm turning 49 exactly, and I'm already like mentally preparing myself for 50.
How do you feel? Like how have you gone through the classic like midlife crisis thing?
I think I might be in it a little bit right now. Definitely the how did I get here? What do I want? Mm. What does the rest of my life look like? I mean, I think the thing about the midlife vibe is that you actually know what 30 years feels like.
Jeez.
Or at least 20. Like I moved to New York 20 years ago this year. It feels like it went very quickly. So I know that the next 20 are going to feel even faster. So then you start to see yourself like right in the midpoint of life.
Right.
And I think that's why people freak out.
Yeah.
It's not theoretical anymore. It's like, I'm going to get old and it's going to go really fast now.
Wow. I don't have those miles under me, but I do have the perspective of like, I thought I was always going to be 21. And I thought like 21 was the oldest I was going to be.
Yeah.
And then I'm starting to be like, oh my God, my body's changing. I have like a colony of gray hairs on the right. You know, it's like, it's all starting to happen. And the phrase that keeps scaring me is I keep going, wait, but not yet, right? Like, it's not time yet. And yes, it is. Like, it's what?
It's always time yet. I mean, that's the thing is it's like, so, but when you say that you thought you were going to be 21 all the time, was there a part of you that was kind of defined by being the young one in the room?
Yep. And I remember talking to Chris Thiele because that was definitely the way he defined himself.
Yes. But he still seems like a big kid to me. Like a big kid in the same way that he seems like a big kid.
Well, I was born an old woman. That's why.
Yeah.
But no, he will always be the big kid in the way that his curiosity is undying and like he's just endlessly excited about things. But he told me, he was like, yep, I think I met him around the time he was like just turning 40. He was at the end of his 30s. And he said to me like, yep, I always thought I was going to be the youngest in the room. And then it started to change. And I've kind of took those words to heart. And I know that it's already, it started happening pretty quick. Like when I was turned 25, there's a lot of really talented people who were 19 and 20. And I was like, oh my God, I'm 25. And now I look at 25 as like, extreme is basically the new 21, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. It's such an, I am determined to grow old with grace and I don't want to be threatened. I want to be open to being taught by people who are younger than me and not feel clunky about that. Cause I think that's when things go off the rails.
Well, and the people that were drawn to you, I think probably were putting themselves in a similar position. I mean, I think John Mayer was putting himself in that position. I think a lot of the people that have loved you and supported you have chosen to take that same path and say, I want to learn from this and I want to grow from this.
John is a great example. He's been unbelievably kind to me, but like has always made me feel like a peer.
Yeah.
Never like, I got something to teach you, kid. Yeah. I've learned a lot from him and his attitude towards.
In terms of just the way to be?
Just a way to be. Yeah. And I mean, obviously musically, he's absolutely a triple threat, but I think I just have loved watching this part of his life and how genuinely excited he is about music and about it happening in the decades that we're currently living in.
Yeah. Well, you know, you said this thing earlier about like, what does it mean to strive for the top and how great is it up there anyway? And, you know, and I was thinking like, well, what is the top? I mean, for the longest time I've thought like, I think John Mayer's career is a great career. Like I think, you know, and I know that he probably has felt his own frustrations over the years or whatever, but he's put the music at the front of it, it always seemed to me. And so how do you, you know, how can you ever look back and say like you have any regrets as long as you let the music lead you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think we're always going to be petty
and
we're always going to want for more and we're always going to, but exactly, happiness versus contentment.
Yeah.
Like contentment says that's a wonderful career.
Yeah.
You put the music first. Yeah. And contentment also can speak to you along the way. It's the small voice. It's like, no, you could. Mm-hmm. You could sacrifice yourself for this thing, but don't sacrifice the music. Just don't do it.
Yeah.
And I felt like that has been the path of my life where I have from the beginning been like, this is going to be a slow burn. I felt like that has been the commitment that I made early on, which was to say, this is, the cookie's going to crumble very slowly, yeah, but I want my priorities to be within my control.
Yes.
And that's all I can control.
So what is...
What are they?
Yeah, or what are you... Yeah, what do you want? I mean, what are your priorities and what's leading you right now?
I want to keep making music that makes me excited and that deepens the, like, the well of possibility. And I want to, like, I want to just write better and better songs. I want to be blown away by music, too. I don't ever want to be the person that is not the fan and that is just the, like, you know, the artist.
Yeah.
I want to be all of that. And I don't want to, I want to do my best. I want to position myself to have the curiosity and wonder for it. And so my mission is to not be burnt out. And I want to, of course, like, I would love the audience to keep growing and for people to really give a shit, you know, but that's kind of, I don't know, like, we could talk logistics about things, but that's boring. It's like, it, that's almost not the point. It's more just like, I want, like, the fire to, like, remain.
Right. In terms of logistics, in terms of these are the, this is the size cap room,
yeah,
I want to,
exactly,
be playing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or like this, these are the countries, or yeah, the, whatever. It's more just like, I want the fire to constantly be,
yeah,
lit, where, like, when something happens, people are like, that's honest. Yeah. And I care about that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what else I can.
And as you say, the cookie's going to crumble slowly. Like, as I was listening to this record, I was like, this is a Joni Mitchell. This is an Emmylou Harris. This is a Bonnie Raitt. This is a career artist. This is an artist who's making music that people, like, musicians will respect and fans will want to live with for a long time. And none of those artists are megastars, and yet they're all, like, I think some of the most important, and I chose three female artists. I could have chosen three male artists. It doesn't really, it's not gender specific, but, like, that are just going to do this as long as they live, which is, you know, I think probably the best case scenario for an artist.
That's it. That's all I want,
yeah,
to do. And I'll even work in a restaurant. I would happily do that to continue to make things that feel exciting and truthful, you know?
Well, Madison Cunningham, thank you for making things that are exciting and truthful and sharing them with me today. This has been such a treat.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad we found each other.
I know. I know. There she was, my friends, Madison Cunningham. The slow burn, the cookie crumbles, contentment versus happiness, the open tunings of it all. I'll be back in your headspace again before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.